This is Joffer Papa Pump Penizai, a.k.a. the bad guy, with my main man, John DeMatt. Maz, how you doing, Maz?
I'm living the dream today, buddy.
Bro, you don't even have dreams, bro.
That's because I don't sleep.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So, we are here today with somebody who's very influential to me. I see this person as a coach, a mentor, and this is probably one of the podcasts that I'm looking forward to the most. We have my coach, Coach Eric Haycraft, and his lovely wife, one of the most dangerous fighters you'll ever meet, whether male or female, Miss Lindsay Haycraft. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Good, how are you?
Good, good. So, you know, we don't want to take up too much of your time because we know you guys are really busy. So we just want, real quick, if both of you guys can give us just maybe a quick little synopsis, a little summary on how you guys got into kickboxing and the role that you're playing, such as, you know, Coach Eric, how you became a coach, and Lindsay, how you became a fighter.
Go for it, Eric.
Okay, I guess I'll start. In the 90s, in the late 80s and the early 90s, when I was in high school, I inadvertently got into martial arts. I was doing kung fu. Not really because I had a big interest in martial arts. It was more to do with, I had some friends that wanted to go do it, and I tagged along. And one thing led to another. I eventually started doing American kickboxing in the really early 90s, and then I kind of knew then that Muay Thai and international kickboxing was what I wanted to get involved with. And then I sought those things out. Had an amateur and a professional fight career that didn't lead to too much. And then around the early 2000s, my body started falling apart. I had a hernia and then some neck injuries that kind of made it easy to decide to retire from professional fighting and become a coach full-time. And pretty much since the 2004, that's what I've been doing as a job, as a career, is coaching and training fighters. And that's me, so I'll turn it over to Lindsay and tell hers.
Eric left out one really important part, and one of the reasons why he's such an amazing coach, too, is in the early 90s when he went over to Holland to train, he realized pretty quickly that his aspirations to be a world-renowned fighter were pretty limited, being in the U.S. at that time. And so he's told me that at that time, even when he was still fighting, he was kind of transitioning his thought process into being a coach. So when he was learning different tools for his fights in the ring, he was actually absorbing them and finding ways to express them as a coach, kind of putting them in, you know, in the back of his mind and using for later, which I think is one of the reasons why he's such a phenomenal coach. So I don't want him to leave that part out because I think it's important. But how I became a fighter is completely opposite. I've been an athlete my whole life, mostly soccer and gymnastics. And when I was a freshman in high school, I had to decide between the two, and I did not have the body of a gymnast. I kept getting taller and hitting my feet on the uneven bars, so it was pretty easy for me to decide that soccer was the sport for me that had the most longevity. And I actually, in the off season, would do this fitness boxing. I thought I was a badass. Eric tells me later that I was terrible, but it was in Cincinnati where I was from. So I would, in the off season, like I said, I do this fitness kickboxing, circuit training at this awesome gym in Cincinnati. I was reflecting on how lucky I was that even just kind of randomly picking a gym to do cardio work, I found a really good boxing instructor who taught it as a class. It wasn't just a gimmick, and so we ran sprints, and he trained me well, even for just recreational. And I came down to Louisville on a scholarship to play at the University of Louisville. And when I was down here, I really missed that kickboxing, boxing, fitness aspect of it. It was a good stress relief, and I think it really upped my game on the field. And so one of the girls I was in class with, just a random classmate, had me come to a self-defense class with her because she didn't know of any boxing. I was like, yeah, okay, I'll try it. And I did that for, I want to say 6 or 7 months, and it turned out to be Krav Maga, and I was terrible on the ground stuff. So I came in to an open gym because I was like, well, I'm going to get better. I came into an open gym where there were jiu-jitsu guys, and at the time it was really pretty uncommon for females to be doing jiu-jitsu or anything of that sort. Obviously not now, but, you know, 10 years ago it was. And all these married men looked at me, and they're like, yeah, we're not going to roll with you. So I was like, oh, this is stupid. And Eric just happened to be finishing up a Muay Thai class, and he saw me in the lobby and said, hey, you know, you should try my class. And, well, kind of the rest is history. I was hooked after that and pretty much never set foot doing self-defense or fitness kickboxing again. So
you pretty much got into kickboxing because Eric was hitting on you and wanted you to join his class.
Oh, no, he definitely wasn't hitting on me at that time. There's a 12-year age gap, so I was a baby when you met
me. She was really young.
I was 19, so...
That's legal.
Maybe, but no, we were coaching a student much longer than before we started dating. He was smart. I think if he would have tried to hit on me when I was 19, it wouldn't have worked out so well, and... He was not. I didn't like when I first saw him. His hair dyed blonde. He was too much of a pretty boy when I first
saw him. Oh, snap. Now, when did this relationship, how far into you training, again, becoming a fighter, did it kind of like blossom into more like, wow, you know, I like this person more than a student. I like this person more than just someone I see on the regular.
Yeah, I mean, like, my coaching style is very involved, and I demand all these athletes, they're here a lot. We spend so much time together, and because there is zero kickboxing or Muay Thai in our area, we have to travel a lot for all of our fights. So we end up on the road together a lot. We end up, this is with all of my fighters, not just Lindsay. And Lindsay, when she started fighting, once she finished school, and we could really pursue her, the beginning of her career, it went really fast. She was fighting 11, 12 times a year.
Wow.
We were fighting all over the country. So we were on the road a lot together. And I think it was probably 2007, 2008-ish, building up to that before we ever started dating, we started having all these atypical problems between a fighter and a coach. And, you know, like if I yell at my other guys, they don't typically yell back at me. They usually bite their tongue. And so we start having just these really stressful altercations. And it would just, we couldn't figure out why it was happening. And I think everybody else figured it out around us before we did. And we really became an amazing team. I mean, I enjoyed traveling to all the fights with her and doing all the training. And, you know, long before we got married, she used to be a lot more obedient. So it was, we made a great team.
Let me just say something. I've seen you tell her to do something, and man, it is the scariest thing I've ever seen, because you'll be like, Lindsay, keep your hands up. She goes, they are up! And then I'm like, whoa!
It wasn't always that way.
I remember there was a point you yelled at her, and she yelled back, and I was sparring with her, and I went, oh my god, this girl's going to beat the crap out of me right now.
No, it's difficult, but that's something I also need to work on.
I think I've actually, of course, over the years, I mean, really, most of the top female fighters in the world that are not gay, actually end up dating or are married to their coaches.
Whoa, so it's kind of like ancient Greece.
So I should start coaching.
If you like fighter kids,
it's a common problem, you know. It was like when I really had those problems. As I talked to other coaches that were, you know, coaching their significant others, they said, oh, yeah, it's the worst idea ever on the planet.
No,
and, we've managed to make it work. We both, you know, like, because we made such a good team in the beginning, I think those qualities carry over even when things are bad. So she's very hot-headed and blows up for a very short amount of time, completely irrational. I'm just the opposite. I'm too rational. And it just kind of stalls out any fights. So nothing ever escalates into anything damaging because it just stalls the fights out. I'm the opposite of fighting. She's ready to throw down. Nothing happens.
We get
over it. She's a little crazy. She is crazy.
Let me just tell you something, because my fiance is one of my fighters too, and yeah, it's usually their fault, right, Coach?
No. Listen,
you're coming
listen,
back here.
I'll tell you this. It's the difficulty for the a spouse is, and Lindsay is, a lot of our fighters now are in the same position. They want so desperately to uphold the reputation of the team and of me as a coach, and a lot of pressure falls on her because people expect that she's going to, you know, to be a certain way all the time. So that's a lot of extra pressure that a normal fighter wouldn't have. And I have to remind myself of that pressure sometimes. A normal fighter, my guys, I am the pickiest coach there is. So I dissect everything, and I demand perfection.
And he's hardest on me.
And I'm not, I won't say I'm the hardest on her, because but the problem is, here's the problem. With my other guys, they go to their home at the end of the night. With Lindsay, she comes to my home at the end of the
night. Our home, thank you very much.
And so that, it's really difficult for me sometimes to stop trying to get my point across. So sometimes well into the late hours of the evening, I'm still pitching a game plan or pitching a strategy or dissecting problems.
We're pretty good at that, though. We're good at keeping things separate for the most
part. It's gotten better, but I do catch myself sometimes, and it can be relentless on her, you know, for her. So that it's not all on her. It's definitely both. It's a challenge for both of us.
Now, Eric, I have a question for you. You talked about kind of like straying away from the competitive fighting game in the early to mid 2000s, and you know, most people that do fight competitively or train competitively, it's really hard to make that transition from fighter to coach. And you said you kind of had a few injuries. How hard was that for you to kind of leave the actual, you know, being a competitive athlete to kind of moving over into like the more of a management and coach role?
Yeah, well, Lindsay kind of actually touched on it in the beginning. If I back up all the way to the very beginning of my career, I had one amateur fight. It was in Niagara Falls, New York, and I fought one of Suchard's guys in 1993. And I lost that 3-round decision in that fight. I instantly took off for Holland. I wanted to go somewhere and train. I had Roman Deckers on a pedestal back then. Most people in the States had no idea who he was. And I was just infatuated. I had collected every video, every magazine, everything there was to find out about him I had.
And I basically what I'm doing with you.
Yeah. VHS tapes.
Yeah, except,
he's got
except,
a lot more to
me. Yeah, except Ramon was like a legend in the sport. So, you know, when I tracked those guys down, they invited me over to come and train. And I left. I was 19 years old, and I got on a plane. And I thought, here I am. I'm doing it. I'm going to Europe. Nobody was doing stuff like that in 1993, 1994. The Dutch guys, I asked them, what will it cost for me to train? They said, we don't know. No, just get over here and let's figure something out. And as soon as I got there, a lot of things became apparent for me. First, you know, I showed up, the first week they said, come to all the training sessions. And of course, I couldn't wait to train with all these guys that I knew that were like legends. And so when you walk into the A-class training sessions or the fighter training sessions, there's also some B-class guys in there. You had guys like Ramon, you had Luke Verheyen, you had Michael Lufat, all these guys that were just legends. So, and from there, it dropped down a tier from world champions to European champions to Dutch national champions. And, you know, there's 30 people in the room, and if you added up all their fights, you're probably well into the 300 to 400 range of fights. And it was just insane. It was an insane amount of experience, and everybody in the room was training for a fight. And one guy had a fight on Saturday, the other guy on Friday, and the other guy was going to fight the following week. And then the two guys were fighting also the next week on one of the weekend days, and all in different cities. And every weekend that I was in Holland, we went to fights either in Holland or Belgium every weekend. And they had high-level coaching there with Cor Hemmers, and Cor had a staff of assistants. And it became apparent to me that the structure did not exist first in my own training at home for me to be even marginally successful. And moreover, it was obvious that the United States did not have the structure. There was no way I could fight every weekend living in Kentucky.
You're fighting. One time
I was lucky. I was literally lucky to fight in the 90s, in the early to mid 90s, being in Kentucky one time a year if I was lucky. And that's if I was lucky. I remember one year I trained for the whole year for one fight, only to get it canceled.
Oh,
no fight that year, you know. And if you fought one time a year and you lost, you had to wait months and months and months and months and months to try to have another fight to make up for it, you know. So you got to live with that. It was just really difficult. But I think subconsciously, by the time I finished my first stint in Holland, I did not admit it to myself. I only know now in retrospect. I knew then that it wasn't going to be me. Like I could have some fights, but it just wasn't the structure for me to do it. It was going to be somebody further down the line that I either participated with or trained or, you know, had involvement with. It just wasn't going to be me. And it was just the wrong timing. I was born in the wrong place at the wrong time for me to really make a serious career out of something like that. And I think that even though I never admitted that to myself, I kind of set out on the career of being learning to coach and learning to fight simultaneous. I was running most of my own training camps for the majority of my career anyway. So, it really wasn't that difficult because as things started to play out, I only had 17 fights total. And it just, you know, by the time it was done, it was done. I didn't have a hard time walking away from that. It definitely was not, you know, I had a very serious neck injury. I had a disc rupture and the material inside the disc ejected and stabbed into my spinal cord. And I'd have surgery to pull that off the spinal cord. My right arm didn't work. You know, the doctor had told me, you know, the day he finally got me in and looked at the MRI, he said, "I'll see you tomorrow." And I thought he was kidding. And he goes, "If you want to use this arm ever again, I'll see you tomorrow." And incidentally, I was grateful to do anything in the sport at all. So it was an easy transition. He told me, "Yeah, if you want to get hit in the head, that's your choice, but you could be back in here with this again." That I did not want, because the next time around, maybe I don't have my arm, and then maybe I'm not involved in the sport at all. And I think that all those things that were in my subconscious, I knew that my real contribution to the sport was going to be as a coach.
Well, you know, I feel like you made the wise choice. And also, too, you know, when you can't be guided the right way, I think you did something really great, which was you brought in all the tools so you could later on guide people and you could create for them what you never had. So I actually really find that admirable.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Now, Lindsay, I got to tag you in real quick.
Okay.
So, Lindsay, I know in the beginning you were getting a ton of fights. They were coming left and right, and then I know right now, currently, it's really hard for you to get fights. So let's touch up on that, how it went from staying really busy to now you're in a situation similar to Coach Eric was, where the fights are scarce and you really have to go all over the place. How is that like for you as a competitor?
It is what it is. You know, it was frustrating because I did fight very frequently in the beginning of my career, but that's pretty typical because as an amateur, I could do all the tournaments. So a lot of the times I'm fighting 11, 12 times a year, I could fight 2 to 3 times in a weekend, a couple times, you know, a year. And that's why I feel like the amateur tournaments are so crucial to developing your career. Now, unfortunately, as a female, there's a big jump. After those first 10 fights, you know, the air gets really thin up there, and there's really far and few to choose from. And so we had to start getting creative and doing international fights, and that's even more of a jump because, you know, you kind of know where you fall in the U.S., but, you know, I was going in blind, and it was really difficult because if you're fighting overseas, you know, they're not bringing you in to promote you. You're there to fight the other girl, usually in her home country, in her hometown, so you're just there by yourself, and you know, I think it's made me a much stronger fighter. But I mean, that's just my lot. I live in Louisville, Kentucky, you know, if I lived in California or in New York where it's more popular, I would be the girl that the promoter's promoting because then he could bring fighters in for me to fight. But in order for me to fight somewhere in the U.S., I'm from out of town. My opponent's going to be from out of town, even more likely maybe out of country. It's just, it's a cost-benefit ratio, you know, equation, and unfortunately, in my situation, I'm going to lose that just about every time, and it's frustrating, because I think a lot of the times I had such good momentum in the beginning of my career, and like Eric was saying, when he would fight one time a year, maybe he didn't have a great fight, maybe his head wasn't in the right place, and, you know, he didn't really get to learn from it until a year later, so it happens to me all the time. I might not have the best fight, or I might all that pressure, I might not handle it the way I want to, and then I kind of have to live with that for a long time until that next fight comes up. And, you know, I just, finally learned to just kind of let go of it and just I do it for me and I do it for Eric and I enjoy it instead of worrying about what am I going to do this fight? Is it I got to make up for that last fight just because it, you can't do it that way. You're not going to be successful. So it's definitely frustrating, but like I said, it's not personal. It's business. So it's kind of I'm grateful for whatever opportunity I get and we make use of every opportunity. We grasp for every opportunity that comes our way and we roll with it. So So far, so good.
I have a quick question for you. One second. I mean, a lot of people that we've been talking to in the fight game on that top-tier amateur or mid-level professional fighter, I always have a question of, are you able at this point in your career to make this a full-time job? Like, can this sport, with kind of the little bit of credibility that it has in the States, be able to afford you to live a lifestyle of fighting?
As our manager, I'll answer that.
I'll answer that, too.
Yeah, listen, it was never going to be. If she was the best girl on the planet, it was never going to be anything she could. The top girls in the world are not making a living doing this. First of all, there's a huge, huge, huge pay disparity between males and females. Secondly, for kickboxing, unless you're in a very, very small segment of the population of fighters, you're not making a lot of money doing fighting.
Even males.
Yeah, that's everybody.
Yeah.
You know, not enough to live. Not enough to live. Even if you're making $6,000 per fight and you fight three times a year, that's poverty level income. You're going to have a job aside from that.
And I had that mentality. I knew this is my love, and I knew I would never really make money with it, so I never did it to make money. We've had a hell of a ride, and I've gotten to see the world from it, another person's dime. But I've put myself through college and grad school. I have a clinical doctorate in physical therapy, and I'm a pediatric physical therapist. So I kind of planned for this as I was training. Because I have my own business and I see kids throughout the day, so
right.
It's a lot of work. I'm very fortunate that I have two passions. I absolutely love what I do for a living, and I love what I do for a passion. And so I'm seeing kids in the morning, I'm training, I'm going back and seeing more kids, I'm training more, and I'm doing my paperwork at night. So I'm literally working all day, but I set myself up in a position where I don't have to rely on a paycheck for my fight, you know, to make a living. So, and I think that also allows me a little bit more longevity as well in this, because at some point you have to make a decision, but if you're not in that position to support yourself, if you can fight or if you kind of got to throw in the towel and go get a job that, you know, can support yourself.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to tell all my guys, but let me back up real quick and talk just before the original question, because it ties right into this, is when you're an amateur, you're going to be able to fight constantly. Because there are 3, 4, and maybe even more this coming year, amateur tournaments that you can participate in, have multiple fights over a weekend. On top of that, then you can find amateur cards that are regional that you can become a part of. So you can fight very often. Once you turn professional, there's cost involved now, and it becomes much thinner of an opportunity, becomes much more infrequent to fight. You can go from fighting 12 times a year to 4 times a year to overnight. So I always tell people, you need to get as much experience as possible, because if you're going to be that 1% of the fighters that can actually do this eventually for a living, you're going to need as much experience as possible, because you're going to have to make a jump to be able to fight international fighters or go international to compete. So I tell people, don't, you know, there's so many guys that are ready after a dozen fights, 20 fights even. I'm ready to go pro. I want to be pro because they have a fascination with the idea of being a pro. What they don't realize is being a pro in the beginning means you're going to make $300 if you're lucky on some show somewhere. And maybe you live in a city where you can sell some tickets and that makes you some money too. But the reality is that's not making money fighting. That's you making money selling tickets. And then if you just want to do that, you can go to any promoter tomorrow and say, hey, let me sell some tickets for you. They'll let you do that whether you're fighting on the card or not. But as a fighter, you're not going to make a lot of money in the U.S. fighting. You're not going to make a lot of money in the beginning in Holland fighting. No matter where you're at. It's really those, all the guys that made it to the top, they never set out because they were trying to get rich. Nicky Holsken never set out in the beginning because he was trying to be rich. It turned out that after he had 70 fights, they all looked at each other and said, holy shit, I'm good. Let's do this thing. You know what I mean? And that's how you're going to approach it. So if you fast forward to the way I bring all my guys up, first thing I tell them is get a career that's going to let you play this game for as long as you can do it. That's going to let you you know, if you need to get an education along the way, you know, Lindsay's a freak of nature, but, you know, Lindsay was training all the way through her PhD and then started her fight career. You know, and there's a young man that I manage named Brian Collette who has a college degree already. You know, those are ingenious ways to make sure you can take a time out in life and chase a dream. And if you're not one of the 1% that are going to make a lot of money, you've got somewhere to go when you're done, because you're not going to make a whole lot of money. You're really not. And even the guys that, you know, if you're fighting in the States and you go, you have a small window, you make $100,000. You're probably going to buy a house and then you're broke again. You're going to have a career, an education, a job, something after that's over with. So it's best not to think of this as a way to make a living. It's better to get a career that allows you to train and do these things.
Now, yeah. there was something you actually put online, Coach. I believe it was the three or four things you need in order to actually commit to being a fighter. And I remember reading this, and it was like a mind ninja in my brain. And I was in the shower, and when I thought about it, it like exploded my brain, and I was in the fetal position going, holy crap, I can't do this anymore. Because there was I believe it was like the means, the responsibility. I wanted you to go into that again, because that was so profound to me.
Yeah, the will, the means, and the opportunity. You have to have the will to do what it takes to get there. You have to want to do it. You have to have the means to do it, which means you have to have that job that lets you, you know, if you're an amateur and you're going to go do an amateur tournament, it's expensive. You know, I just took three fighters to the WKA tournament. We have to drive there. It's an 8-hour drive for us. We have to pay our gas there and back. Gas is almost $4 a gallon right now. We have to pay for our hotel while we're there. We have to pay for all of our food while we're there. We have to pay for medicals for all the athletes to compete. They have to pay a fee to compete. And we have to all pay license fees to the WKA. That's not atypical for any of the tournaments. All the tournaments require those things. It's hundreds of dollars to just do amateur tournaments out of your pocket. In order to do that, you have to have a job that's going to allow you to do that, a job that's going to allow you to leave and be gone for those things, be flexible enough, and still let you afford all the other things that you need to do with your bills and your life or your education, if that's one of the things that are on that list. So that's the means, you know, you have to have that. Also in means is the right gym where you have training partners and you have coaching and you have, you know, the hours are accommodating to when you're trying to do your stuff with everybody else. And then you have to have the opportunity. And the opportunity is a really tricky one, because a lot of people in the USA think that being good is enough. And unfortunately, being good is actually pretty far down on the list, because opportunities come a lot of times from who you know and what you're willing to do. You know, for girls, opportunities can arise if you're one of the girls that likes to tweet pictures of your panties. That sometimes leads to a lot more opportunity than just being a badass fighter. That's unfortunate, and I'm not going to hate on those girls for doing it. I wish it wasn't that way, but they didn't make it that way. So if they want to take advantage of that, I can't hate on them. If everybody decided not to take advantage of that, that would probably not exist anymore. But that's opportunity. Opportunity comes from, you know, having connections. This is the only thing I've done my entire adult life. So
over those years,
it's starting to finally manifest that I've got tons of opportunities for all these athletes.
No, ever.
And we have opportunities for these guys. So
you're saying, you know, when I was fighting, to make more opportunities, I should have taken a picture of a sock around my crotch and put it online.
I'm telling you, listen.
You can try it. Worth a shot.
Infant socks are cheap.
Oh, man. So now... and this is a funny story, because I think I'm going to actually let you guys know this. So, Coach, you had mentioned that there was that anti-cancer ad about the guys putting a sock on their genitals. So, John's been my best friend for 10 years now, so he comes over this morning before the first podcast we have, and I have a sock on my crotch.
Oh, no.
And I think his response was, I hate you, and he left.
I literally opened the door, and he's like, hey... in just a sock. I'm like,
that's pretty funny.
Friend will tell you like it is.
That's pretty funny.
Meanwhile,
so that was inspired by you, by the way.
Meanwhile, I'm on like 5 hours of sleep because I flew back from the other side of the country, and I wake up and first thing I see is this.
Like I said, me and him are like brothers, and we play pranks on each other. And
yeah, I never did that to my brother.
You know what it is? It was Sibling Appreciation Day or something the other day, so I realized.
You're a grasper for Stroud.
Oh. Okay.
So now, going back to you two, there's something I wanted to ask. What's the worst fight you two have ever had when it came to training?
They're all about the same. It's usually right around where I'm starting to cut weight. And I'm really, like, I've gotten better with it over the years to a point. And then I'll hold it in, and then all of a sudden I'm just, like, a super bitch. Like, we've had some crazy, crazy travel things come up. I mean, where you think, like, we've had a whole entire, airplane strikes, we hitchhiked from, in Spain to get to where we needed to go with a nice couple we met on a plane. I mean, we sat in a parking lot in China for 3 hours with a guy speaking any English. Like, I mean, we have crazy stories, and all the time I'm usually cutting weight. I'm trying to cut weight at, you know, we got storms and our flights canceled, and I'm cutting weight in the airport the day of. I mean, so typically what happens is I try to hold my shit together as long as I can, and then all of it's like some crazy travel thing will happen, and I'll just lose it, and I'm just a super bitch. But usually Eric tries to keep his cool for the most part, but once I make weight and I get the fuel I need, I'm a lot better. But I try really hard to avoid that. But I'd probably say that's probably the most upset he gets at me.
Yeah, there's never really, it's always the same types of problems. It's just emotional stuff, you know. It's just, yeah, that's it. Never any real problems. I mean, she thoroughly believes in the system that we have. I mean, it's, if you come up in this system, it's really impossible not to believe in what we're doing, because we've got such a wide range of athletes that have all excelled to such incredible levels, and they're all the people the least likely candidates. You know, like, you go to some gyms, there's always going to be a guy, it didn't matter where he was at, he was going to be awesome.
He got computer
crap. We've got everybody from every walk of life, and they've competed and done amazing on whatever level they wanted to take it to.
That's
so actually, I really thoroughly believe in our system. I think that it works, and I know she believes in that, so we don't have problems with that. You know, I am very demanding. It's right or it's not, and there's no gray area for me. And I'm relentless with that. And there's a lot of times that she just doesn't need to hear that.
I'm tired. I've worked all day.
Unfortunately, I'm not programmed to offer anything but that. I'm also brutally honest. So, you know, you can win your fight and walk back to the corner to me saying that was crap. And, you know, when you do good, I'm going to tell you. If it's not what I wanted or what I expected, I'll tell you. That's difficult. And I can understand it's difficult, but I feel like I owe it to these guys to give them everything that I've got, so they can do as well as they can do, so they can be as safe as they can be.
Yeah, no, nothing major, just your typical spat. But you know, we're both adults and we handle our shit. And after, explained it perfectly. After I throw out, I'm fine, and he's usually mad, but he's the rational one, so he can kind of take it all in, relax, and wait till we get through it. But yeah, nothing major, just the usual.
Well, Eric, you kind of touched on something that I was curious, because Joffrey had mentioned a few times on how special he felt your gym was. And, you know, myself, I don't really come from a striking background. I come from more of a grappling background. But we've both had the opportunity to travel around and train at a bunch of gyms all over the country and all over the world. And for some reason, this guy keeps wanting to go back to your facility. So to me, that must mean that you are doing something special over there. You kind of touched on some of the things that set you apart, but can you kind of just dive like real deep into like your perception and like kind of your strategy of why you seem to be kind of like the guru in this industry and your part of the world?
I think it's the culmination of doing this my whole life. You know, it really is the only thing I've done my entire adult life. I've wore every hat you can wear in the game. I've been involved as a fighter, as a coach, as a promoter, as a manager, as a journalist. I mean, matchmaker. I mean, you name it. I really have. I've worked with every major promotion there is. I've been all over the world with it. I've seen from the most basic amateur fights up to the highest level of fights. So I think I have a wealth of knowledge now, and that allows me to, you know, I've also had the best coaches I think I could possibly have, for me at least. You know, it's I've always kind of been a little bit of a nerd, and not only a nerd, but like a
obsessive.
Yeah, a little bit obsessive. I'm kind of a Rain Man with the stuff that I'm interested in. So I can't remember anybody's phone number, but I can remember
every VHS tape from the 70s.
Yeah, every fight I see, I can remember it and recall it. Like, you know, without a problem. I mean, if I'm teaching something to somebody, I can instantly give them 7 fights that have that thing I'm teaching in it for them to go and watch. And all that stuff kind of came together when I started kind of putting my own system together.
And so, it's very systematic. I think that's also a difference, is it's very repetitive, and it's tedious, but if you're a real athlete, and I've played sports my whole life, that's how you learn. It's repetition, and you do the same stuff, and you get better at all your basics. And we're a bread and butter gym, and he's developed a system that's just that, you know, it's your basics over and over and over until you get good at it. And then just now, do I get to see even just the iceberg of all the oh, well, if you set this up with something basic, you can do this trick, or you can set this up. It took me 10 years to get to that point, you know, but it's just, if you look at all of our favorites, you know, if you look at like Rob Kamen, Ramon Decker, you look at all them, yeah, they had awesome tricks, but they had Ernesto Hoos, just amazing basics. And if you don't have that, you don't need all this crazy stuff, because it's not going to work if you don't have that. So I think that's also where it comes in. He has this wealth of knowledge, and he's done just an amazing job organizing it into a very digestible way for a massive amount of people. Like you said, we have people all across the board that are our teammates, all different walks of life, and they've all been successful at this sport and in different degrees, but all successful, all safe. And I think that's a testament to the system that we have in place. So, and that's kind of how it goes.
I'm not sure if that answers your question exactly.
No, I don't think
there's anything. I think I don't have any one thing that's completely special about me. I'm not the absolutely best pad holder there is. I'm good at it. I'm not the absolutely best corner man. I'm good at it.
No, you are pretty damn good. You did win me a world title.
I'm not where I want to be. I mean, the guys that I look up to, you know, like guys like Core Hemmers, you know, like I want to be that when I'm 60. You know, that's my goal. So I'm absolutely gunning. I'm very competitive. I didn't stop competing ever. I just transitioned to being a competitive coach. I want to be the best coach that I can be. And the guys that I look up to for coaching, guys like Andre Monard and Core Hemmers, those guys, they have, you know, like I would never compare myself to those guys yet. And I want to be on that level. So I'm always learning. I'm always absorbing stuff. And, you know, when I learn new stuff from those guys, I don't come to the gym and teach it the next day. I go to the gym in the mornings, and when I'm by myself, I do all of those things hundreds and hundreds of times until I know it, understand it. Sometimes it doesn't fit with what I want in my system, and I don't use it. But if I eventually integrate it in, it's only after I really understand it, maybe even after I pick their brain about it 10 more times. So, I mean, I'm always constantly trying to become a better and better coach.
You've left out one thing, though. I think probably the biggest reason why he's such an amazing coach is this man genuinely loves this sport. I mean,
no way.
That's genuine. It's crazy. Like, it's fun for me to go. I remember sitting at a Glory event in Chicago, and he was sitting ringside next to Core, or when we're around Core, when we're around any of these guys that he looks up to. And I mean, like, he looks like a little kid in a candy store, and he's looking out. I have a picture of him I took, because it was just crazy. He's watching, I don't even know who it was, it might have been Nathan Corbett, he's watching a fighter walk out to the ring, and he's just beaming, like, he's just smiling. He's so happy to be there. He's every fight he'll watch 30 times over, especially if it's a good one. I mean, he gets excited when he's sitting next to Core and they're writing down notes about fighters they see, and he's on par with what Core said, or Core is listening to his opinion. I mean, he's excited and always and genuinely in love with this sport. I mean, his whole life, practically, well, the better part of it. And so I think that also is what makes him a phenomenal coach, is he doesn't do it so he can wear the badass tracksuit that he has, or it is pretty badass. Okay, maybe a little bit for the tracksuit, but he doesn't do it for his image or what. He does it because he genuinely loves it, and he loves what he's doing, and I think that also comes across, because he'll spend time with anyone to go over something. He wants anyone in the gym to come to him, and he will explain whatever we're doing in depth, whether it's a fighter or someone in the fitness class. And I think that also speaks volumes for why his reputation as a coach in the gym is what it is.
It's funny, too, because I know everybody in this area is so sick of me mentioning Coach Eric, because the truth of the matter is, now he looks up to Core Hammers, I look up to him. Like, the way he probably looks at Core, I look at him. Everybody I know over here is like, all right, will you just shut up and tell us that you're gay for him? And I'm like, look, he's my hero. This guy is, like, literally doing what I want to do. So it's so cool to see that you still have people that you look up to, and you're constantly evolving. It's kind of inspiring that there is no end to this.
Yeah, of course, man. That's the nature of all sport. I mean, you can't ever stop growing. I mean, this is a very all sports are dynamic. I mean, if you look at collegiate basketball, we just finished March Madness here, and one of our major universities, University of Kentucky, was in the final championship game. But if you look at just how the sport has evolved every 10 years, how much different the game is, how much faster it is, and that you have to evolve. If you're a coach that's not trying to constantly learn, become better with your strategies, stay with the times. I mean, if you take kickboxing over the last 30 years, man, it's completely changed. I mean, I've had to adopt a lot of, as fights have become more and more three-round fights instead of five, we've had to change our approach a lot and change our pacing. You've got to be constantly wanting to be better and adapt and learn. That's not the case. You're going to get stagnant and you're going to get left behind.
Now, we want to go into one thing real quick. We all know that, you know, from Sean Fagan's podcast, we know that you're involved with Glory as a talent scout. How is that basic job, how has that been for you? Has it been stressful? Has it been taxing on you? Or is it something that you genuinely enjoy? And how does it affect your day-to-day life?
Yeah, it's all those things. I mean, it's stressful on me because it's super important for me that Glory does well in the USA, because Glory needs to do well in the USA for it to exist. USA is like the last untouched market for kickboxing. It ran its course in Japan. Maybe it'll come back in Japan, but it's not what it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. It's as big as it's going to be in Europe for now. So the last market is the USA. So I was like one of the first guys that they picked up. Yeah, not first. I mean, I'm the only guy that they picked up in the talent operations division from the USA. And all of the fighters and the opinions and the stuff that come out of the States and the strategies, I've got a big say in those things, and it's stressful because I don't want to mess those things up. I don't want to have any part of any decision I make be a hindrance to the propagation of the sport in this country. So I'm very thoughtful of that. I try to be as fair as possible. There's so many fighters that when we did the Road to Glory tournaments, there were a lot of fighters that I'm not necessarily friends with. There's a lot of fighters that, you know, I don't have any relationship to, but it was my opinion that they deserved a chance in those tournaments. So I gave them those chances in the tournaments. We made it happen for them. And, you know, some of them capitalized, some couldn't, but regardless, they deserved those chances. And I think that's really one of the things that's kept the sport down in this country, is that it hasn't necessarily been about the people that deserve chances. It's been more about who you know, and it's been about keeping the people that really deserve chances from getting them. And in the long run, that only, it keeps a real sport from existing. And so that those things were a little bit stressful, but I also welcomed those opportunities because it was important that, you know, I wanted to have a say in that. I wanted to have a voice in all those things. Aside from that, it's been amazing. I mean, just to watch how fast I've learned a lot. I mean, I had to learn You know, I've dealt with fighters' contracts for all of our athletes, you know, all the way up to a Bellator level, which are pretty substantial contracts. But when we got into the Glory contracts, man, those are some really weighty, 20-plus long, you know, and it's in international language, which makes very little sense to most of the American guys. So I've learned a whole lot on the legal end about those contracts, and learned a ton about production and what a network like Spike is looking for and trying to achieve and their expectations. And it's been very interesting. Glory had its growing pains along the way. And, you know, we were all very protective of our little nugget, our responsibility. Each person had their job. And, you know, in the beginning, we all knew who the best people for each job was. And we didn't necessarily know anything about the people in the other divisions. And then, you know, we were defensive, so we were like, you know, everybody was doubtful, like, oh, is this a mistake? Is that a mistake? And, you know, now, as it's played out and everybody's got to know everybody and see everybody, the results of everybody's work, you can see that Glory really does have the best people for the job in every spot. And it's got a better chance of actually doing something in the USA than it's ever had. And if everybody just tunes in, and on Saturday night on Spike, there's a big show from Istanbul, and it's going to be amazing fireworks. And that's where it's going to take from here on out. It's just going to take everybody tuning in, you know, to watch it, not necessarily DVR it or get at their friends' houses and watch it, but, you know, to watch it, tune in on their own television, support it.
Now, we're basically going to start wrapping up. We just want to know, we have two more segments real quick, so this one, we just want to lead into it. What are some shout-outs that you both have, family members, sponsors, anything like that?
We don't have a lot of shout-outs. I mean, we're very gracious to everybody that's always helped us along the way. I'll tell you what I would like to do. I'm worried. One of my guys, Jordan Satterly, he after training today, he started having some chest pains. He had to go to the hospital, and he's actually in the hospital right now. For a while, I've been talking to you guys. I've been checking my phone for text messages from him, and he just got, you know, it doesn't seem now they don't have anything that's an emergency right this second, but they're running a lot of tests. Try to find out. And I've been a little bit preoccupied, worried about Jordan right now. So I know he'll listen to this, and I want him to know that I'm thinking about him, or at least I was thinking about him today. Other than that, you know, like my best friend in the entire world that made all of this stuff possible when I decided to stay in Kentucky.
Damn it.
Aside from my sock wearing amigo, is a guy named David Schwartz. He's one of the guys he's been with us for a really long time. Always had our back. And, he's just, you know, he's really like, without Dave, it would have been a totally different situation right now for everybody. So, you know, that's, I don't know if Lindsay's got some people she'd like to.
Just my family, my friends. I love them. That's about it.
Yeah.
Okay, our next segment, and we're actually going to have to do this with each one of you, is called our random question segment, where we don't think about the question. It may be outlandish. It's the first thing that just pops out of our head. So
it could be perverted.
Oh, either that could be bad.
It could be really bad.
It could be perverted. All
right,
bring it.
So we'll start with Lindsay, and John, you go first.
Boxers or briefs?
Are you asking both of us at once?
This is Lindsay first.
All right, ready?
Yeah.
Boxers or briefs?
What?
I have no idea.
Briefs.
Okay, so the mixture of the two. Okay. All right. I got to empty my mind for this. Okay, it's emptied. All right, if you had to hit Eric with any blunt instrument, what would that instrument be?
probably a laundry basket.
A laundry basket.
That popped my head. Yep.
Okay, now
it's tied to the laundry.
All right, Coach Eric, you're up next.
Okay.
Favorite midnight snack.
Oh, cheese.
Cheese.
What kind? From under?
It doesn't matter. No, definitely not from under.
Okay.
I think that's only popular in the Northeast. It's not so popular down here.
Okay. So, all right, I'm going to empty my mind, and here you go. Have you ever secretly been into 5'5" guys who are of Afghani culture and brown skin? Wear socks on their
You know, I have not, because if I were to say I was, you would be heartbroken. let's go with not.
Guys, thank you for being such great sports. Thank you for coming on today. This was awesome, and we really appreciate it.
And I look forward to seeing you soon, Joffer.
Yeah, definitely. And